ensure that there was enough daylight left for the horses and mules to graze, Dregeth decided to camp for the night near the village and trade for fresh food. He had a couple of packs of cheap goods for just this kind of barter, and as he told Jill, the villagers were more than willing to trade beef and bread for coloured ribbons and copper brooches.
"Besides," Dregeth said, "it'll give Lord Corbin a chance to come down and buy summat if he wants. Always be courteous when you're passing through someone's domain."
Although the Lord himself never appeared, one of his councillors did. Jill was hanging around, watching Dregeth haggle with a farm wife for a barrel of ale, when the man rode up on a beautiful silver-grey horse. He was tall but slender, with dark violet eyes, and he had the palest hair that Jill had ever seen, practically the colour of moonlight, and cut long to fall over his ears. He dismounted and strolled over to Dregeth, who was just handing over an iron skillet in return for the ale. At the sight of him, the farm wife turned pale and backed off. Jill noticed her making the sign of warding against witchcraft with her fingers as she hurried away.
"My name is Lovelane," he said, in an oddly soft and musical voice. "Are you carrying any fine weapons?"
"Some swords of Lucarn steel, good sir, the finest there are."
While he examined the swords, Lovelane ignored Jill completely, and she was glad of it. Although he was courteous enough, there was something about him that creeped her flesh, and it wasn't only that he smelled of rose scent. At last he picked out the best sword in the lot.
"Well and good, Counselor," Dregeth said. "And is it for you?"
"It's not, but for my lord, a token of my esteem."
"An honourable gift indeed. Now, I usually get a decent horse for one of these blades."
"How about a gold piece instead?"
Lovelane flashed him a cold, hard smile.
"I have coin, unlike the rest of the stinking rabble in this part of the world."
"Splendid! A fair price indeed."
"Far too high, actually. But there are some things that must never be haggled over."
Although Dregeth looked shocked at such an idea, he took Lovelane's gold the very regal quickly enough. He even found a bit of cloth to wrap the sword in, escorted the counsellor to his horse, and held the bridle while Lovelane mounted. With a small contemptuous nod, he rode off, sitting with the ease of a man who spent most of his life in the saddle. Dregeth scratched his beard in puzzlement.
"Now that was a strange one, lass," he announced. "I've seen many a man in my trading, but that was a strange one."
"He was. I half wondered if he wanted that sword to stab his lord or such like."
"Odd, I had the same thought. But listen to us, Jill, insulting a man we don't even know. Did you see his horse? It's a Western Hunter, one of the breed I'm after. His lord must honour him highly to give him an expensive animal like that."
That night, Jill had a dream, and grotesque though it was so clear and coherent, so filled with small details, that she was forced to admit that it had to be a true dream. She saw Lovelane take off his clothes in the middle of a chamber, then go to a window. She heard him chanting aloud in some peculiar language, then all at once he was enveloped in a flash of blue light and turned into an enormous red hawk. When he leaped from the sill and soared above the countryside, she somehow was flying up above him. Suddenly he stooped and plunged, just like a real hawk, and came up with a rabbit in his beak. Only then did she realize just how unnaturally large this hawk was. She woke with a start and sat up, listening to the reassuring sound of Cullen snoring nearby. The dream was so disgusting that she felt cold all over. To rid herself of it, she rose and went over to the river bank. In the moonlit shallows, the wild folk of water disported themselves, an ebb and flow of faces in silver foam. When she put her hand in the water to call them, they clustered round and rubbed silvery backs against her fingers.
"Do you know Counselor Lovelane?"
She felt their terror break over her like a wave. Then they vanished utterly, leaving the river only ordinary water. Jill ran back to camp and burrowed into her blankets as if they'd hide her. Much to Jill's relief, on the morrow the caravan packed up early, clattered over the toll bridge and headed west, far away from Lovelane. All morning the men and mules wound their slow way through the prosperous farmlands of Eldith, past stone-fenced fields and round farmhouses, and through meadowland where white cattle with rusty red ears grazed. At times, Jill rode rearguard with Cullen, at others she rode beside Dregeth, who, true merchant that he was, loved to have an ear to talk into. He began telling her more about the horses he hoped to obtain.
"We call them Western Hunters," Dregeth said. "Even the mare stands 16 hands high, and they've got the best wind you'd ever hope to find in a horse. But here's the big thing, lass. Some of them are golden, well, a yellowy brown, really, but in the sunlight you'd swear they were made of gold."
"By the hells! I don't suppose a silver dagger would ever get the coin to buy one."
"Not likely by half. The West folk know their value, and they make you trade high. Worth it, though. If I can get a golden stud, the Gwarbret of Camanwain will give me 2 gold pieces for him."
Jill caught her breath. 2 gold pieces would buy a decent farm. Suddenly she remembered Lovelane again, handing over a De Very Regal for a sword worth 1/3 of it, if that. Why had he insisted on cheating himself that way? Odd bits of bard lore drifted to mind, and at last she remembered the persistent tale that if a Dwayoma man wanted to enchant an item, he was forbidden to haggle for it.
"Tell me summat," Jill said to Dregeth. "Do you think there's such a thing as a real Dwayoma?"
"Well, now, most people dismiss those tales out of hand, lass, but I've seen an odd thing or two in my day."
Dregeth gave her a sly smile.
"I think me you're going to be well and truly interested in the West folk when you meet them."
Although Jill questioned him further, he put her off with a simple, "Wait and see." Yet later that same day, she had an inkling of his meaning. The farther west they rode, the bolder grew the grey gnome, popping into materialization to sit in front of her saddle, even when she was riding beside another person. His long, thin mouth open in a gaping smile, his green eyes gleaming with excitement, he would grab one of her reins in both skinny hands and shake it, as if trying to make the horse go faster. Finally, she dropped far enough behind the caravan to speak to him.
"You know where we're going, don't you? Do you like the West folk?"
He nodded his head in a vigorous yes, then leaped up to throw his arms around her and kiss her on the cheek. That night, the caravan camped in a pasture beside the last farm on the Eldith border, where Dregeth traded cheap goods for loads of hay and fodder. Jill discovered the reason on the morrow. Just an hour's ride brought them to primeval forest, a tangle of old oaks and bracken, where what little grass there was grew thin and straggly. All day they followed a narrow track through ancient trees, standing so close together that it was impossible to see more than 10 feet beyond the trail. They made their night's camp in a clearing that was just barely big enough to accommodate men and mules. Everyone huddled around a campfire to talk in strangely hushed voices. Every now and then, one of the men would turn sharply to peer into the forest as if he felt he were being watched, then laugh at his own foolishness. Jill, however, knew they were being watched. Just beyond the circle of firelight, she could see wild folk, clustering thick in the branches of the trees, to stare down at these intruders in their land. The next day brought more forest, but now the land was rising in a gentle slope that promised hills at some far distance. Men and mules alike sweated as the trail wound on and on through the dappled dark forest. Finally, some 4 hours after noon, they came to a river, churning white in a deep gorge. Over it, in a graceful arch, was a stone bridge, as well made as any in De Very. The side rails were carved in a looping pattern of leaves and vines, and here and there in roundels were chiselled marks that had to be letters in some utterly alien alphabet. As the caravan clattered over the bridge, Jill studied the carvings. Here and there, as a decoration, the face of one of the wild folk peered out through a cluster of stone leaves.
"Dregeth," Jill said, "did the West folk build this bridge?"
"They must have, lass. No one else out here to build it."
Then, Jill supposed, the West folk had to be able to see the little creatures she could see. It might explain why the wild folk here were so bold. That night when they camped in another clearing, the wild folk wandered in for a closer look at these interlopers. They strolled around, peering at the muleteers, touching anything shiny with long, pointed fingers, occasionally pinching one of the horses just to make it stamp. Although only Jill could see them, most of the men could feel that something peculiar was going on. They turned sullen, sitting close together and concentrating on dice games, snapping at each other too, over every roll. Eventually, Cullen would step in, speaking to every man personally and judging the games. Jill began to see why Dregeth wanted her father along. Fortunately, at about noon on the morrow, the caravan broke free of the forest. As the land rose, the trees began to thin, until finally they left the last of them behind and came to a wide, flat plateau. Ahead, wind-ruffled grassland stretched out like a green sea out to the horizon. Although Jill was glad to be out of the forest, the plain had its own eeriness too, simply because she had never seen any view so empty.
"Are there any towns or such like out here?" Jill said.
"Not that I know of. But then I've never been much farther than this. Just a few miles along now, there's a place where I always camp and wait for the West folk to find me. They always know when I'm here. It's an eerie thing."
The wild folk told them, Jill assumed, but of course she wasn't going to tell Dregeth any such thing. When they came to the campsite beside a pleasant stream, hundreds of wild folk flocked around, considered the caravan for a few minutes, then abruptly disappeared. That night, Jill had trouble sleeping. She kept waking to lie on her back and look at the stars and the great drift of the snowy road, which seemed to hang closer to earth out there. For all her restlessness, she never heard anything moving near the camp, but when dawn broke, two men of the West folk were there. Jill woke for the last time to see them standing quietly a few yards away, waiting for the sleeping camp to rouse. They were tall but slender, with deep-set eyes and moonbeam-pale hair like Lovelane's. Their faces would have been handsome if it weren't for their ears, which rose to a delicate point like the curled tip of a seashell. Even though Dregeth had warned her that the West folk cropped their children's ears as babies, Jill still found the sight unnerving. They were dressed in leather boots and trousers, and cloth tunics, heavily embroidered in a free pattern of flowers and vines that splashed across one shoulder and trailed down the front. Since she slept mostly dressed, Jill got up and walked over barefoot to greet them. When she was close enough to notice their eyes, she was in for another shock. Their irises were enormous, with barely any white showing around them, and their pupils were a vertical slit like a cat's.
"They don't do that when their children are babies," Jill thought. "I wonder how Dregeth explains that away."
Her feeling of being faced with something totally alien was so strong that she nearly yelped aloud when one spoke to her in perfect Deverian.
"Good morrow, fair maid," he said. "Have you and your menfolk come to trade?" "We have. Our leader's name is Dregeth."
"I know him truly."
He cocked his head to one side and studied her with a faint smile.
"I've never seen one of your women folk before. Are they all as lovely as you?"
When Jill stood there, tongue-tied, he laughed and made her a bow.
"Tell Dregeth we'll bring the others."
They walked away, glided away really, without the slightest sound, as if the grass were parting to let them go through. At some distance they'd left their golden horses. Jill stared after as they mounted and rode out of sight. Just past noon, a tribe of West folk rode in from the grasslands in a long procession of mounted riders, driving a herd of horses ahead of them. The group turned out to be an entire clan, men, women, and a few children, all dressed exactly alike, except that the women wore their long hair severely braided, like the very women of the dawn time. Instead of wagons, they dragged their possessions along behind them on wooden travoy. A couple of hundred yards from Dregeth's camp, they pulled up and pitched their own. Fascinated, Jill watched the organized swarm of activity as everyone in the clan lent a hand to raise round leather tents, unpack their belongings, and tether out the horses. In less than an hour, the camp stood as if it had always been there, a gaudy, noisy affair of brightly painted tents, running children and dogs, and swarms of wild folk.
"Now we wait some more," Dregeth said. "They'll come when they're ready."
Sure enough, a few at a time the West folk strolled over to see what Dregeth had brought them. Singly or in pairs, they walked through the rows of cooking pots and knives, swords, woodsmen's axes, shovels and arrow points. Occasionally they would squat down and pick something up to examine it, then lay it down again, and all without a word. As she grew used to them, Jill found herself thinking them beautiful. They were graceful and lithe, with a self-possessed dignity that reminded her of wild deer. She was surprised to find that the muleteers, and even Cullen, looked on them with scorn. That entire afternoon, the men stayed down by the river and played dice with their backs to the proceeding. Only Jill sat with Dregeth in the grass and watched his customers. When the sun was getting low in the sky, a young man came over with a leather meadskin.
"Good morrow," he said. "We're pleased with the trinkets you're offering us."
"That gladdens my heart, janitor," Dregeth said. "So we'll trade on the morrow?"
"We will."
Jennatar handed him the skin.
"For your men, to sweeten their hearts a bit."
Seeing that he knew the men despised his people embarrassed Jill profoundly, but he merely smiled in a wry sort of way as Dregeth hurried over to the muleteers. When Jennatar sat down beside her, the grey gnome appeared in her lap and leaned back with a contented smile.
"Here," Jennatar said sharply. "Do you see the wild folk?"
"You mean you do?"
"All our people know them. We call them by a name that means the Little Brothers."
When she looked into his smoky grey, cat-slit eyes, Jill could feel the kinship there, for all that the wild folk were ugly and deformed, and these beings men called West folk were beautiful.
"You know," Jennatar said, "there's a man of your people who rides with us. I think he'd like to meet you."
Without another word, Jennatar got up and walked away, leaving Jill wondering if she'd insulted him. It was getting on towards sunset when an old man came from the West folk's camp. Since his eyes and ears were normal, even though he dressed like one of the West folk, Jill assumed that he must be the man whom Jennatar had mentioned. He was not very tall, with heavy shoulders and arms, though the rest of him was slender, and he had enormous brown eyes and white hair that swept up from his forehead in two peaks like an owl's horns. When he hunkered down next to Dregeth, his posture was somehow bird-like too, especially the way his hands hung loosely between his thighs. It turned out that Dregeth knew him. He introduced him round as Aderyn, a name that made Jill giggle because it meant bird.
"I've come to ask a favour, Dregeth," Aderyn said. "I need to travel to Cannabane, and I'd rather ride with a caravan than on my own."
"You're most welcome. But what is this? Are you suddenly feeling longing for the folk you left behind?"
"Not truly,"
Aderyn smiled at the jest.
"This is an unpleasant little matter of justice, I'm afraid. One of our people murdered a man, and now he's a fugitive. We've got to fetch him back."
"Unpleasant indeed. He should be easy enough to find, eh? He'll stand out among Eldeth folk."
"Not truly. He's a half-breed, you see."
"Councillor Lovelane."
The words burst out of Jill's mouth before she could stop them. When Aderyn turned her way, Jill felt that he was looking through, not at her, as if his casual glance would nail her down like a farmer nails a shrike to a barn wall. After some moments, he smiled and released her.
"Well, his name is Lovelane, sure enough. Now you must be Jill."
"I am."
Jill was certain that she'd never told any of the West folk her name.
"Have we met, good sir?"
"We have, but not so you'd remember."
For a moment, Aderyn looked melancholy, as if he wished that she would remember.
"But why did you call him Councillor Lovelane?"
"Well, that's what he called himself. He's part of Lord Corbin of Brothlyn's retinue now."
"Indeed? And isn't that passing strange? Well, at least we know where to find him, then."
Aderyn rose, glancing off into the night.
"Most strange it is, truly."
He walked off without even a backward glance.
"Here,"
one of the muleteers spoke up.
"Is that old man daft or such like?"
"Oh, I wouldn't call him that,"
Dregeth said, thoughtfully scratching his beard.
"He has his little ways, but his mind is as sound as an oak."
The muleteers exchanged doubting glances.
"Must be daft," Cullen muttered, "running off with the West folk like he did."
Although Jill knew better than to say so aloud, she was thinking that running off with these people didn't seem like a daft idea to her. Later that night, The music started. Across the moonlit meadow, a woman's voice started a melancholy melody. Three other voices picked up a harmony that sounded out of key, until Jill realized that they were singing in quarter tones, just like the bardic minstrels one heard every now and then down in the port towns. Suddenly, instruments joined in, a cool, clear sound like a harp, then something that made a constant drone, and finally a small drum. The music came faster, faster, flowed from one song to the next with barely a pause. Cullen and the men crowded close together and concentrated on dice. Jill slipped away and went to stand on the edge of the camp. Across the meadow, torches flared among the jewel-bright tents. Drawn as if by Dwayoma, Jill took a few steps forward, but suddenly Cullen grabbed her by the shoulder.
"And just what are you doing?" Cullen snapped.
"Listening, and nothing more."
"Oh, horseshit. Listen, don't you dare sneak off. Those people are more wild animals than they are men, but I wouldn't be surprised if you please their men well enough anyway."
"Oh, ye gods, da! You think every man I meet is lusting after me?"
"Most of them are, and don't you forget it. Now come along. You can hear this blasted squalling well enough by the fire."
Even for a Tyrin with a vast domain, coin was hard to come by in Western Eldith. Since Dun Canabain was only Lovian's summer retreat, she had to send back to her main residence, Dun Gwerbin, for silver for the soapmaker's daughter. When it finally arrived, Hrodri was incensed to find that his mother expected him to deliver it personally.
"Why can't the Chamberlain go?" Hrodri snapped. "Or the wretched Equerry? Let them earn their meat and mead."
Levian merely crossed her arms over her chest and glared at him. With a sigh, Hrodri picked up the pair of saddlebags from the table and went to the stable to get a horse. The morning lay clear and sunny over the wild green meadow, and far below at the base of the cliffs, the ocean sparkled like a casket of blue and green jewels. But Hrodri rode out with a heavy heart.
"Olwyn's going to weep," he told himself, "and it's going to be horrible."
What Hrodri could never admit to another living soul was that he was honestly fond of Olwyn. It was one thing to tumble a common-born lass around in bed, quite another to admit that you liked her and felt more at ease with her than with a woman of your own class. The town of Canabain lay nestled around a small harbour in a break in the cliffs, where the Brog, a stream that only qualified as a river in the winter, came to the sea. There were three wooden piers for fishing boats and a larger pier for the ferry that went out to the holy islands of Umglith, about 10 miles out to sea. From the piers, about 400 buildings spread out in ragged semicircles. Although Isgaren's soapworks lay about a mile from town to spare the residents the stink of tallow, his family lived in a roundhouse down near the harbour. Rodri's courtship had been so successful because Isgaren and his wife were up to their arms in grease and potash all day, a good long ways away from Olwyn, who tended the younger children at home. As soon as Rodri dismounted to lead his horse through the narrow curving streets, he realized that he was in for the worst morning of his life. The townsfolk all bowed or curtsied as usual, but he was aware of hastily repressed smirks and snickers everywhere he went. Although he was the lord and they the commoners, satire was an injured man's right, and apparently Isgaren had been exercising it to the hilt. Rodri tied his horse up behind the house and slipped in like a thief. Olwyn was chopping turnips at the battered table in the kitchen. She was 15, a slender little thing with a heart-shaped face, big blue eyes, and a charming triangular smile. This morning, however, she looked up without the usual smile when Rodri came in.
I've brought you summat.
Rodri laid the saddlebags on the table. Olwyn nodded and wiped her hands on her apron.
"Do the terms of the settlement please you?" Rodri said.
She nodded again and began unlacing the bags.
"My mother sent along some honey and things like that."
Rodri began to feel desperate.
"Things that are strengthening," she said.
She nodded a third time and began taking various pots and sacks out of the saddlebags.
"Olwyn, please, won't you talk to me?"
"And what do you want me to say?"
"Oh, by the hells, I don't know."
Olwyn took out the small wooden box of coins, opened it, and stared at the heap of silver for a long time, her chance at a decent life. Rodri paced around the kitchen while she counted out every coin.
"By the goddess herself," Olwyn said at last. "Your mother's a generous woman."
"It's not just her. I wanted you well provided for."
"Truly?"
"Truly. Ye gods, what kind of a man do you think I am?"
Olwyn considered the question with a weary sort of look in her eyes.
"A better one than most," she said at last. "Are you waiting for me to weep? I've done all of that that I'm going to do."
"Well and good. Will you give me one last kiss?"
"I won't. Just go, will you?"
Rodri took the saddlebags and headed out, pausing to glance back and see her calmly putting the coins back in the box. She looked more relieved than sad to have him gone. He mounted his horse and trotted out fast, letting the townsfolk get out of his way as best they could. His heart wasn't lightened any when he returned to the dun and found the page waiting for him with the news that his mother wanted to speak with him straight away. Although he wanted to make an excuse and duck out, he could never avoid the fact that Levian was no longer merely his mother, but his overlord, to whom he owed fealty as well as filial respect.
"I'll wait upon her directly," Rodri said with a groan.
Levian was standing by the window in the reception chamber. The harsh morning sun brought out the wrinkles slashed across her cheeks and the grey in her once dark hair, but she was still an imposing woman, if a bit stout from bearing four sons. She was wearing a white linen dress kirtled with the green, silver and blue plaid of the Maelwyths, but thrown over the chair behind her was the red, brown and white plaid of the Clu Coch, the symbol of the Tyrannrin. It struck Rodri as odd that after all these years of thinking himself a Maelwyth, one day he too would wear that foreign plaid.
"Well," Levian said. "I handed it all over."
"Did the poor lass weep?"
"Frankly, I think the poor lass was cursed glad to get rid of me."
"She might be indeed. You're very handsome, Roddo, but I've no doubt that you're a very wearing sort of man to be in love with."
Rodri had the horrible feeling that he was blushing.
"The midwife tells me that your Olwyn is about 3 months along," Levian continued. "She'll be having the babe around the Festival of the Sun. Since it's her first, it'll doubtless be a bit late."
"I wouldn't know, I'm sure."
"About such women's matters?"
Levian raised one eyebrow.
"It's time you realize that upon these women's matters rest the strength of every clan in the kingdom. If your uncle had had a bastard son, I wouldn't be Tyrin. You might think about that."
Rodri flung himself into a chair and refused to look at her. With a sigh, Levian sat down nearby.
"The real trouble is you were never raised to rule," Levian said. "No one ever thought you had the remotest chance of inheriting anything, so your father got you the best warrior's training he could and left it at that. You simply have to marry soon. And she's going to have to be exactly the right sort of woman, too."
She hesitated, assessing him.
"I suppose it would ache your heart to marry a plain lass or one older than you."
"It would."
"Now do try to be sensible. Here, what's all that clatter outside?"
Rodri realized that for some minutes he'd been hearing noise out in the ward. Giving thanks to the gods for the interruption, he went to look out the window. Servants scuttled around, greeting a troop of men on horseback. Rodri could see the dragon device on their shields and the blue, silver and green plaid of the rider at their head.
"Ah, by a pig's cock," Rodri said. "It's Rhys."
"If you could please watch your tongue around your brother, I'd be most grateful."
When they came down to the great hall, they found Rhys standing by the honour hearth. At the head of the table, the plaid of Aberwyn lay over the chair to announce that the Gwerbret's presence superseded that of the Tyrin. Rhys was just Rodri's height, but stocky where Rodri was slender. He had the raven-dark hair and cornflower-blue eyes of the Maelwyths, but his face was coarse rather than fine, the jaw a little too square, the lips a little too full, the eyes a little too small for the breadth of cheek. When Levian curtsied to him, Rhys bowed with an affectionate smile. Rodri's bow he ignored.
"Good morrow, your grace," Levian said. "What brings you to me?"
Not that I care to discuss in your open hall.
I see. Then let us retire upstairs.
When Hrodri started to follow, Rhys turned to him.
See that my men are well taken care of, he snarled.
Since it was a direct order from the Gwerbret himself, Hrodri gritted his teeth and followed it.
You bastard, he thought. I have to ride this war you're discussing ever so privately with Mother.
The cluttered reception chamber looked even smaller with Rhys in it. Refusing a chair, he paced back and forth, stopping occasionally to glance out the window. Levian took the opportunity to collect her thoughts. This was bound to be a touchy interview, straining the delicate balance of power they'd worked out between them. Since, as Gwerbret, Rhys was her overlord, she was bound by law to follow his orders, but since she was his mother, he was bound by custom to follow her advice and pay her every possible respect. For the past year, they'd done an uneasy dance to this difficult bit of counterpoint.
"Why do I hear rumours of rebellion out here?" Rhys said finally.
"So, they've reached Aberwyn?"
"Of course."
He trotted out the old proverb with a certain point.
"Everything comes under the nose of the Gwerbret of Aberwyn sooner or later."
"And have you heard that Sliggan believes the rumours?"
"Sliggan isn't given to fancies. Does he have proof? Letters? Things he's personally overheard?"
"Naught. Yet I can send for him if his grace would like to speak with him."
"Do you want to make a formal deposition to my court? I doubt if the case would stand if all you have is Sliggan's gossip."
"Doubtless not, especially if his grace has already decided that the information is gossip."
"Oh, here, Mother. Corbin was one of your brother's most loyal men. He pledged you willingly when he inherited the Vran, didn't he? Why should he throw all that over and declare himself in rebellion?"
Talking of Dwayoma would draw Rhys's scorn and nothing more. Rhys misinterpreted her hesitation.
"Unless, of course," Rhys said, "the trouble's Rhodri."
"And what makes you think the trouble could be Rhodri?"
"He's an untried man, and I didn't hear any rumours until you made him your heir. I don't think he's fit to rule myself."
Rhys held up his hand flat for silence.
"Now I know Rodri's a good lad with a sword. But leading men to battle is a cursed sight easier than giving judgments on your vassals. If you disinherited him, I'm sure all this grumbling about rebellion would stop."
"I have no intention of doing anything of the sort."
"Indeed. Well, if Sliggan gets real proof, of course I'll rule that you have every right to your rank and lands."
"My humble thanks, Your Grace."
Rhys winced at the sarcasm.
"But if the lords throw Hrodri in my face," Rhys went on, "that may have to be a point of negotiation."
Levian rose to face him. Although he towered over her, he ducked back out of reach.
"There is no law in the land," Levian said steadily, "that will allow you to force me to disinherit Hrodri."
"Of course there's not. I was merely thinking that Her Grace might have to see reason and do it of her own free will."
"Her Grace also has the right of appeal to the High King."
Rhys flushed scarlet with rage. It was his sorest point, knowing that although he ruled like a king in Western Eldith, there was a true king in Deveri with jurisdiction over him.
"Very well, Mother," he said. "Then if Rodri's to have your lands, let him fight to keep them."
"Oho! So you do believe the rumours?"
Rhys spun around and stared out the window. Levian laid a maternal hand on his arm.
"Rhys, my sweet, why do you hate Rhodri so much?"
"I don't hate Rhodri,"
he snarled, his face redder than before.
"Indeed?"
"I just happen to think he's unfit to rule."
"I happen to disagree."
Rhys merely shrugged.
"Very well then, Your Grace," Levian said. "There's no use in discussing the matter further until it comes to a formal case of either law or sword."
"Apparently so. At the first overt act of rebellion, you may send for my aid, and my warband will be at your disposal to enforce the laws."
And yet, he'd made it impossible to ask his aid, unless she wanted to let him disinherit his brother in open court. That afternoon, while Rhys and his men drank in her great hall, Levian sent a message to Sliggan to come to her on the morrow.
When she rejoined her sons, Rodri was sitting at his brother's left and discussing hunting dogs, a fairly safe subject. Levian sat down at the Guerbret's right and stayed on guard for the trouble that soon, predictably, surfaced.
"Well, brother," Rhys said, "I hear from your men that you've been hunting a different kind of game than the grey deer. The soapmaker's daughter, was she? Well, at least she'd be clean."
When Rhys laughed at his own jest, Rodri's eyes went dangerously blank.
"I can't lie and say I didn't dishonour her," Rodri said. "Tell me, brother, has your wife conceived yet?"
Rhys's hand tightened on his tankard so hard that his knuckles went white.
"Rodri!"
Levian snapped.
"Well, mother, it seems a reasonable question."
Rodri shot his brother a sideways smile.
"Since we're talking about siring sons and all."
With a flick of his wrist, Rhys threw the ale in his tankard full into Rodri's face. Shouting insults and the worst oaths they knew, they were on their feet and shoving at each other before Levian could intervene. She jumped up and ran round the table to push herself between them, and for all that Rhys had the higher rank, she slapped him too.
"Stop it!"
Levian yelled.
"What a splendid example you are for your men, brawling like a pair of servants!"
"My lords, kindly remember who you are." They both had the decency to blush. Rodri wiped his face off on his sleeve and stared down at the floor. Rhys collected himself with a sigh and held out his hand.
"My apologies. And you have mine from the bottom of my heart."
Rodri took the offered hand. But the handshake was as brief as they could make it, and Rodri stomped out of the hall. Rhys and Levian sat down and waited while a servant refilled the Guerbret's tankard and scuttled away again.
"My apologies to you, mother. That was an ill way for me to treat your hospitality. But ye gods, the rotten young cub made me furious."
"What he said was uncalled for and cruel." Rhys studied the tabletop and rubbed a bit of rough wood with his thumb. Finally, he looked up with a brittle smile.
"Well," Rhys said, "aren't you going to tell me that it's time I put my wife aside?"
"I know she pleases you, and never would I wish that bitter weird on any woman. I take it your counsellors have been pressing the issue again."
"They have. That's another reason I rode to Cannobane, to ask your advice. I know Aberwyn needs heirs, but it aches my heart to think of Danila living shamed on her brother's charity."
With a sigh, Levian considered. Rhys had been married for 10 years. He was now 28 and his wife 26. If Danila was going to conceive, surely she would have done so by now.
"If you do put her aside," Levian said at last, "I'll make provision for her. At the very least, she can come to me as part of my retinue, but I might be able to do better than that."
"My thanks. Truly, mother, my thanks."
He rose abruptly.
"If you'll excuse me, I need a bit of air."
Yet Levian knew that he was close to tears. For a long while she sat at the table alone and brooded on those women's matters that lay at the heart of the kingdom. On the morrow, Rhys and his men rode out early, much to Levian's relief. His stubbornness over the rebellion puzzled her. It was, after all, to the Guerbret's advantage to intervene before things came to open war, both to assert his authority and to issue a warning that rebellions would not be tolerated in his ran. Later, while speaking with Rodri and Sliggin in her reception chamber, she found an answer to the puzzle that nearly broke her heart.
"High-handed of him, eh?" Sliggin said. "Never known his grace to be so unreasonable."
"Indeed."
Rodri favoured them with a cold, tight smile.
"All my life, Rhys could always hold one thing over my head, and that was that he'd get the Guerbretian, and I'd have naught but his charity. And then Uncle Quarick has to go and get himself killed, and lo and behold, I've got a ran after all. Of course it aches the bastard's heart."
"Here," Sliggin snapped. "Don't call your brother that. Your lady mother had more honour than to put horns on your father's head."
"My apologies to you, mother. Let me refer to the esteemed Guerbret as a piss-poor drunken excuse for a noble lord, then."
"Rodri!"
Levian and Sliggin said together.
"Well, by the gods!"
Rodri got to his feet.
"How do you expect me to be courteous to a man who wants me dead?"
Suddenly, Levian turned cold.
"Can't you see it?" Rodri was shaking with rage. He's letting the war go on in the hopes of seeing me killed. I'll wager Corbin and Norek see it too. They kill me off, then sue for peace, and Rhys ever so honourably makes them give restitution to his poor mother. Then, when you die, the rebels have what they want, direct fealty to Rhys, and he has what he wants, my lands.
Rodri leaned over her chair.
Well, mother, aren't I right?
Hold your tongue!
Sliggan rose and hauled him back.
You're right enough, but don't go throwing it in your lady mother's face.
Rodri strode to the window and looked out, gripping the sill with both hands. Levian felt as if Rhys and Rodri physically had her by the arms and were ripping her apart. Sliggan watched her with concern.
Don't you brood, Your Grace. We'll keep your young cub alive. He knows how to swing that sword he wears, and he'll have plenty of loyal men around him.
Levian nodded mutely. Sliggan hesitated, then sighed.
My lady, we'd best leave you.
It seemed to take them forever to get out of the chamber and close the door.
Ah, ye gods, Levian whispered aloud. I never thought he hated Rodri as much as all this.
She dropped her face into her hands and let the blessed tears come. Much to Jill's delight, it took Dregeth some days to finish trading with the Westfolk. One at a time, either a man or a woman would lead a horse over and sit down in the grass to haggle leisurely with the merchant. When that deal was done, an hour or two would pass before the next horse made its appearance. Since most of the Westfolk knew no Deverian, the man named Jennatar stayed with Dregeth to translate. In her self-appointed role as Dregeth's assistant, Jill came to know him fairly well. The second afternoon, during a break in the trading, Cullen came over and insisted that Jill take a walk with him down by the river.
I wish to every god and his wife that you wouldn't spend so much time hanging around old Dregeth. I know cursed well it's the stinking Westfolk you want to talk with.
Duh, I just don't see what you have against them. They're not animals. Look at their clothes and their jewelry, and then they built that bridge over the river. Somewhere they must have farms and cities and such like.
Indeed. And I suppose you'd like to ride off with that Jennatar and take a look at them.
What? Duh, you're daft. He's got a wife and a baby, and he's never said one wrong word to me.
Oh, horseshit. There's more than one man in the world who's had a wife and didn't mind having a pretty lass, too.
Duh, I don't even know what to say to you when your temper takes you this way.
Cullen stopped walking, turning a little to look over the endless green of the grasslands, and his mouth went slack and weary. Jill laid a hand on his arm.
"Da, please, what's so wrong?"
"Oh, may the gods blast me if I even know, my sweet. It aches my heart being out here. For years I thought it was the edge of nowhere, and now I find out there's this cursed strange folk riding around out here, and they've been here all along, and..."
He shrugged in inarticulate frustration.
"And, well, you're going to think me daft, curse it, but they stink of Dweomer and witchcraft. So does that Aderin fellow."
Jill couldn't have been more shocked if a performing bear in the marketplace had suddenly started declaiming a bard song. Her stolid warrior of a father, talking of Dweomer.
"Well," Cullen snapped, "I said it sounds daft."
"It doesn't, truly. I think you're right."
He looked at her for a moment, then slowly nodded, as if he'd been waiting for her judgment upon the matter. Jill felt a cold streak down her back. As if to mock her, the grey gnome popped into manifestation nearby, grinned at her, then vanished again.
"Da, I'd never leave you. If you thought I would, then truly you were daft."
Cullen relaxed, smiling at her softly.
"Well and good, then, my sweet," he said. "My apologies. You can watch our merchant haggle if you want to. We'll be getting out of here soon enough."
Jill took him up on his offer and went back to the trading. When she sat down beside Jennatar, he raised a quizzical eyebrow.
"Doesn't your father think I'm fit company for you?" he said.
Jill merely shrugged.
He started to say more, then suddenly jumped to his feet with an oath for trouble brewing. Two of the Westfolk were arguing with a frightened Dregeth, who was clasping the last remaining sword of Lucorn steel.
As Jill followed Genitar over, she heard them arguing about who was going to buy it.
"Now here," Dregeth snapped. "I never promised it to either of you."
The two men looked only at each other in an anger, the more frightening because it played over such beautiful faces.
"Jill," Genitar hissed, "go fetch Adarin, quick." Without thinking, Jill ran to the Westfolk's camp.
At the edge, she stopped, suddenly bewildered by the profusion of bright colours, the gaggle of children and dogs, the unfamiliar language that swirled around her.
A few at a time, Westfolk strolled over and surrounded her. When a dog growled, she stepped back sharply.
"Adarin," Jill said. "Genitar told me to get Adarin."
The people merely looked at her.
"Please?"
Jill tried again.
"Where's Adarin?"
They glanced at each other, their cat-slit eyes totally expressionless. Jill felt a little flutter of panic around her heart. All of them, even the women, were wearing long knives at their belts.
"Please, Genitar told me to come here."
One man glanced her way, but he said nothing. Jill wanted to turn and run, but they were standing close behind her, too. Then she heard Adarin's voice calling out in their language, and the crowd parted to let him through.
"Genitar said to fetch you," Jill said. "A couple of your lads are fighting over Summit."
Adarin swore under his breath.
The camp, which only a moment before had seemed to understand not one word she said, muttered and swore at the news.
Adarin grabbed Jill's arm and hurried her across the meadow, surprisingly fast for such an old man. When she glanced back, she saw the crowd trailing after them. Back by the trade goods, Genitar stood in between the two who wanted the sword, while Dregeth hovered nearby, clutching the sheathed blade in nervous fingers. As soon as they saw Adarin, all three men of the Westfolk began to yell at the top of their lungs. Jill hurried over to Dregeth.
"They're like this at times," he said in a resigned tone of voice. "I'm glad the old man's here to settle things."
Yet it seemed that Adarin's efforts to do just that were proving futile. All the time that he talked in a soothing, patient voice, the two went on staring at each other, arms crossed tight over their chests, cat-slit eyes unblinking. With a shake of his head, Genitar left the bad job to the old man and joined Jill.
Around them the crowd grew, Westfolk and muleteers alike, and wildfolk popped into manifestation in droves, grinning so hard that they bared pointed teeth.
"They've hated each other for years," Genitar remarked. "They're not going to listen now." Eventually, he proved right. Adarin threw his hands in the air and returned to the crowd of Westfolk, who stamped their feet on the ground in a sharp rhythm. The two men slowly and methodically stripped off their tunics, tossed them on the ground, then drew their knives, which were about a foot long and slightly curved on one side of the blade. The blades winked in the sun as the pair dropped to a fighting crouch. Jill felt sick, wondering if she was going to see a man killed right in front of her. In dead silence, the pair circled around one another, their strange eyes narrow, their jaws set. There was none of the ritual boasting and yelling that would have accompanied a fight between two Daveri men, just the quiet animal circling, a few quick feints, a few quick withdrawals, while the sweat sprang up on their bare backs and made their pale skin glisten. Around and around they went, until one made a charge, and the other held his ground. A quick scuffle, too quick to see, then one fell back with his arm gashed open from elbow to shoulder. Dregeth cursed, but the watching crowd of Westfolk merely stamped on the ground again, and briefly, Adarin ran to separate the combatants, who fell back willingly.
"Is it just to the first blood?" Jill said with profound relief.
"It is," Genitar said. "My apologies, I forgot you didn't know." The bloody knife still in his hand, the victor strolled over to Dregeth, who handed him the sword without a word. His head bowed, the loser stood alone, slumped in defeat, and let the blood run down his arm until Adarin grabbed him and forcibly hauled him away.
"So much for that," Genitar remarked, "until the next time they find Summit that annoys them. One of these days the first blood is going to be someone's throat."
When Jill looked at the man she'd been thinking of as a friend, she was caught all over again by his alienness as his smoky-slit eyes stared back unblinkingly.
"They truly are kin to the wild folk," she thought,
and for the first time, she wondered if her father were right to think them dangerous. That night, as she listened to the music wailing from the West Folks' camp, she was glad to be sitting by the fire with her own kind. By sunset of the third day, Dregeth had 12 Western hunters in his herd, including the golden stud that he particularly wanted. And it was a good thing, too, because Jennatar abruptly announced that no one else wanted to trade with him. Dregeth made no attempt to argue with the news, merely walked away to tell the men that they would be riding out on the morrow.
"I'll be going with you," Jennatar remarked to Jill. "Adaran's taking three of us along for guards."
"I don't blame him. I met this Lovelane, and I wouldn't trust him with a copper, much less my life."
"Well, if you lay your complaint with the Tyrin, she'll haul him into her Malover for you."
"Her what? I've never heard that word."
"Malover. It's when someone feels wronged and asks a Tyrin or a Gwerbret to judge the matter. The priests of Bel come too because they know all the laws."
"Oh, well and good then. No doubt Adaran knows all the right things to say."
At dawn of the next day, the caravan prepared for the long march back to Eldith. In the cool grey morning, the mules brayed in protest as the yawning men loaded up the last of the trade goods and the provisions Dregeth had obtained from the West Folk. Jill was helping rope the riderless horses together when Adaran rode up with his guards, Jennatar, and then two men he introduced as Calondariel and Albaril. Jennatar led a horse that was dragging a loaded travoy.
"Come ride at the head of the line with me and Jill," Dregeth said to the old man. "I'll put your men in the rear with Cullen on guard-like, if you don't mind."
"You're the caravan master," Adaran said, smiling. "We ride at your orders."
Since they were heading for Cannobane, the caravan took a different route back. For the first day, Dregeth led them straight south through the long grasslands. Once they saw, at a great distance, the tiny figures of mounted riders and riderless horses heading west, like a ship seen across a green ocean. But if that clan of West Folk saw the caravan, they gave no sign. Jill found herself wondering what it would be like to ride endlessly from nowhere to nowhere, always free like the falcon in the skies. She had such a life herself, but she knew with a bitter certainty that someday her wandering would end. At times she dropped back to ride beside Cullen, and she would notice the grey sprinkling his hair and the web of fine lines around his eyes. The day was coming when some younger man would bring his weird to him in battle. The thought brought such panic that at times it was hard to breathe. On the second day, the caravan turned east. Here and there they came to magnificent stands of forest, but Dregeth knew his route well and led them from wild meadow to wild meadow. Once the track passed through straggly young beeches and alders that had to be second-growth forest, and on the other side was land that had once been ploughed. Packed flint walls still stood, marking out long-gone fields. In pastures, Jill saw tumble-down stone sheds and white cattle gone wild and as suspicious as deer. Since she was riding next to Adaran, she asked him if the West Folk had once farmed there.
"Not the West Folk, but Eldith men," Adaran said. "A long, long time ago it was, but some of the younger sons of Eldith lords tried to colonize out here. It was too far west, and they couldn't keep their holdings."
"And was there trouble with the West Folk over it?"
"Trouble and twice trouble. The West Folk used to roam much farther east than they do now, and they felt they'd given up enough land."
"Here, I never heard any tales about that."
"It was a very long time ago, and Eldith men have forgotten. They've worked at forgetting, truly. But haven't you ever wondered about the names of the rivers? The El, the Delondariel? Those aren't the very words, child."
"Of course. Delondariel's like Calondariel."
"Just so, and Eldith was called Eltadina a long time ago when de very men first sailed here."
Adaran thought for a moment.
"That was 800 or so years ago, if I remember rightly. It's been a long time since I studied such things."
Soon Dregeth called for the halt for the night's camp. Where a stone wall marked out what had once been a field, and scrubby trees grew along a stream, they tethered out the horses and mules and made their camp. Over dinner, Dregeth discussed the route ahead.
"This stream turns into a river farther south. We'll follow it down to the coast, then turn east and march along the sea cliffs to Cannobane. There's plenty of fodder along there for the stock. I'd say we're a good 2 days out, so let's hope this dry weather holds.
Jill felt a sudden coldness along her back, as if someone had stroked her spine with a clammy hand. She was sure that worse trouble than a possible rainstorm lay ahead. Although she tried to talk herself out of the feeling, late that night when she was trying to get to sleep, the grey gnome appeared. He was troubled too, pulling at her shirt, pointing off to the east, and opening his mouth in little soundless whimpers. Finally Jill got up and followed him to the edge of the sleeping camp. He jumped up and down, pointing, always pointing to the east.
"I don't see anything," Jill said.
He clutched at his head in agony and promptly disappeared. Jill went back to her bedroll. Except for the occasional drowsy stamp of a horse or a mule, the night was utterly quiet. Once she heard the cry of an owl, and looked up to see the tiny dark shape of the bird flying against the stars. She dozed off to have troubled dreams that an enormous owl flew overhead, calling out warnings of danger. Just at dawn, she woke with a start. The gnome was pulling her hair.
"Oh, all right," Jill said. "Let me get my boots on and then you try to show me again."
The gnome led her down to the stream, where a giant among the twisted willows stood one old oak. He danced around and pointed to the tree. When Jill looked up, she saw a Darren in the branches. He gave her a sheepish smile, then climbed down, as nimble as a lad.
"I've been keeping a watch,"
a Darren said, and Jill could see that he was deeply troubled.
"We're in grave danger, child. Hurry, go wake your father."
Together they ran back to the waking camp. The men were getting up and stretching, the horses and mules starting to graze. Jill found Cullen just pulling on his boots.
"Da, come with me. Adarin says there's trouble ahead."
Cullen got up and grabbed his sword belt from the ground. He buckled it on as they ran back across the camp to find Adarin arguing with Dregeth, who looked utterly baffled.
"You've known me for years,"
Adarin was saying.
"Please, my friend, you've got to trust me now."
"I do," Dregeth said, "but how the hells can you know? I've never had any trouble with bandits out here, and now you say that there's a whole pack of them waiting in ambush. Doesn't make any blasted sense."
"I can know, and I do know. We've got to do something or we'll all be slaughtered on the road."
From the look on Dregeth's face, it was obvious that he thought the old man had gone completely and suddenly mad. Adarin leaned forward and stared into his eyes. The look of disbelief vanished.
"Of course," Dregeth said. "I'll do whatever you say."
For a moment, Jill's hands shook. Against all reason, she knew that she'd just seen a man ensorcelled. When Adarin glanced her way, she ducked her head and refused to look at him. He laughed softly, acknowledging the gesture.
"Cullen," he said, "do you believe me?"
"I do, and I don't care how you scried them out either."
It was Adarin's turn to be startled. Cullen gave him a weary sort of smile.
"How many of them are there?"
Cullen said.
"At least 30, and they seem to be as well armed as a lord's warband."
Dregeth turned dead white. Frightened muleteers clustered around to whisper the news among themselves.
"We've got to have shelter."
Cullen looked as bored and lazy as if he were asking for ale in a tavern.
"The muleteers have quarter-staves, but they can't use them if they're being ridden down by men on horseback. A patch of forest, rocks, anything to make them attack on foot."
Adarin hesitated, thinking hard.
"Here," Jill broke in. "If there were lords out here once, they must have had duns. Are any still standing?"
"Of course," Adarin said. "Forgive me, I know nothing of matters of war. There's one about 5 miles or so to the south and west. The walls were still there the last time I passed that way."
"Splendid," Cullen said. "We might be able to hold them off long enough for Jill to get back from Canabane with some of the Tyrant's men."
"What?" Jill snapped. "You can't send me away."
Cullen slapped her across the face so hard she staggered.
"You follow orders," Cullen said. "What's 2 days' ride for a lot of stinking mules should be one for a rider with a spare horse to share her weight. You're riding to the Tyrin and begging for aid. Do you hear me?"
"I do."
Jill rubbed her aching cheek.
but you best be alive when I ride back."
The way Cullen smiled, a cold twitch of his mouth, told Jill that he doubted he would be. For a moment she thought that her body had turned to water, that she was going to flow away and dissolve like one of the wild folk. Cullen grabbed her by the shoulders and shook her.
"You're riding for the life of every man in